Radio.
You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
You've had a long day at work, and you can't wait to just get home, take off your shoes, plop yourself down in your favorite chair, and relax. You walk up to your tranquil residential home and your neatly manicured lawn in your quiet suburban neighborhood, put the key in the lock, open the door, and... yes, the pets have gone wild! What were you thinking? Welcome to the show about everything you always wanted to know about exotic pets. Where to get them, what to feed them, and how to care for them. You'll even find out why some people live with a monkey. Now, here's your host, exotic pet expert and author, Bob Tart. Hey, Bob, what were you thinking?
Hi, I'm Bob Tart, fresh from the dentist with a little speech impediment. Here with book character Bill Holm.
Fresh from being ready to go to the optometrist.
And here we are reintroducing our fabulous workshop talk. And part two, Bill, this is going to be part two. Part two of our workshop.
Did anyone listen to part one?
Nope.
Okay.
And so for all the folks who did not listen to part one, here's the long-awaited part two. And I would like everyone listening to this to understand that even though it is a talk about memoir writing in general, it will help anyone.
Oh, it will not.
Who is writing a pet book memoir, because all of the ideas that we discuss apply to pet book writing, because I wrote three pet book memoirs, and this is the kind of advice that I followed.
Wow. No, that's a reason to listen.
So here we go. One thing that helps a whole lot, I think, is to have a very strong beginning, a very strong opening to your book. And by strong, I mean as specific as possible. When I first submitted the opening chapter to Fall Weather to my publisher, and that's a book about kind of an escalation of, that's at a time when we had something like 53 pets, which is just ridiculous. And the criticism I got from my editor was that it wasn't specific enough. It was too general. And I didn't really know what she was talking about until I started looking. And when you read the first paragraph or the first couple pages, it just wasn't clear what I was doing or why or where the book was going. And I think you want to have kind of a sense of that. And I think there's kind of two ways to write a kind of an interesting opening or a gripping opening. You can, two good ways. I mean, there's many ways. But what I try and do is I either start right in the middle of action, and I have a lot of stuff going on, and this just brings you right into the scene right away, and you don't have to wade through a lot of description for the sake of description. I had one friend who was writing a book, and she had a long description of the median in the freeway.
Right away, like the first page.
Yeah, right? Yeah, describing the freeway median. I wasn't sure what that was doing there.
No, not compelling.
No, it didn't advance the narrative. Another way you can do it, too, in a memoir that I think works very well is, instead of having a scene with a lot of action going on, is to have something at the beginning that establishes what the book is about and the theme of the book. And just to make this even more about me than it already has been, I'm going to read just a very short bit from the beginning of Kitty Corner to show you how I started that out with a scene with a lot going on. And then I'm going to read a couple paragraphs from the beginning of Featherbrain, and that shows how I wrote to kind of give an idea more of the theme than of action. I'm going to point out that each reading I do is going to take probably 2 minutes. And
well, that was a hard lesson to learn.
Why don't you tell that little...
Well, we went to a reading, was it in Luther?
Mm-hmm.
And Bob was having some voice problems at the time. And so I was there...
Not writer's voice problems.
No, not voice. That kind of voice. Yeah, speaking voice. And so I was going to read a part of the book, and it was, I don't know, maybe 5 pages or something like that. And so I was in the midst of reading it, and it was in the library there, and there was a number of people, and then from the back, a voice said, "Is he going to read the whole book?" So after about 2 pages worth, and so it was hard to read the rest of it, and didn't feel like, you know, anybody was listening or cared.
Yeah, so from then on, I always warn people how long the reading is going to take. So I don't think this is going to take more than 2 minutes. So this is the opening to Kitty Cornered, And this will take about 2 minutes. Linda burst into the house in her usual doorknob through the plaster fashion shortly after I had finished feeding Agnes. The floor bounced like a drumhead as she stomped the snow off her boots. Peering around the corner from the kitchen, I felt grateful that I wasn't still climbing the basement stairs, or the tremors might have pitched me off where an underfoot Agnes had failed. Linda tossed her boots onto the porch and then shucked off the pair of plastic bread bags that provided the waterproofing her thrift store boots lacked. "I saw that black and white cat again," she told me, with a mixture of excitement and disbelief of a child glimpsing Santa Claus. She was on the edge of the woods, kitty-cornered from the trailer park, but closer to us than when I saw her the first time I went to the store today, and I better not have forgotten to buy the shredded cheese again. I went back to cleaning Bella's cage as Linda chugged into the kitchen. Bella, the parrot, pinched my finger with her beak when I whisked her off the countertop to save her from getting clocked by a sack of groceries. "You have to be a better girl than that," I told Bella. Linda said, "I couldn't see the cat very well through the trees. She was definitely after something and headed in our direction." I pictured the cat running in that oddly unhurried but determined feline fashion, erect body, stiffly trailing tail, legs flickering like the frames of a silent movie. She trotted in a straight line toward our house until the honk of a diesel horn sent her scampering off in the opposite direction. "She'd better not come here," I said. So that's how that starts, and I think it's pretty clear that she is going to come here. And that's what that book is about. Let me say something about one nice thing about a non-commercial publisher is that University of Michigan Press, as I say, is doing Featherbrained, and my anxiety level is like way down now because the only changes they're making to the book are correcting grammar. So I wish they would fact check it because it's about birds. No, I think they're doing that too. But so that's a very nice option if you don't want someone else's fingerprints all over your book.
Well, they narrow it down so much. I think they take I think in their previous books, the ones that were heavily edited, the last two especially, they took a lot of the good stuff out because they seem to want to be everything about one thing, and if it was a bit off that, even if it was important to the story or interesting, they took it out, right? I mean,
yeah,
it is very frustrating and difficult.
Yeah. I had an editor tell me about one of my books, "You have too many jokes in it."
Yeah.
These are humor books. I mean, they're supposed to be funny. So that sort of baffled me. but the truth is when you're writing a book for a commercial publisher, they see it as a product. And they have in mind a certain kind of product they want to create. And in many ways, the author is just an inconvenience for them. They wish they could just throw a switch and the product would appear. Mm-hmm. Maybe elves can create books.
That's a good idea.
Thank you.
I have a question, because talking about products, who is your audience when you with your books? Who do you imagine?
Yeah.
That's
to annoy me, I think, is the main reason.
This probably isn't very good, but I'm kind of my own audience. I try and write in such a way that I enjoy what I'm writing, that it interests me, because otherwise I just won't be able to write a word. So I have to entertain myself, and usually I think if I'm entertaining myself as I'm writing the book, then I'm putting, because I'm really a dull and boring person.
Oh, yeah.
And so that kind of puts a little spark into it. But I try and, I don't know. That's a very good question. I don't know.
I think it's a good point to talk about writing what you enjoy, what you like about.
Yeah.
Well, what things you like and things that will amuse yourself. Because it's so hard to write anyway. I mean, might as well make it as interesting as possible. And then it'll be rewarding in some way, even if you're not trying to turn it into some kind of package thing that's going to sell.
Yeah.
And that's important for, if you're keeping a journal or if you're just writing stories. Think of yourself and think of, if you're trying to write for somebody else and for an audience, it can really be stifling, I think.
Yeah, a lot of times I'll be writing a scene and it'll just feel dead. And I don't know why it feels dead. And then I realize it's because it's a scene I feel I'm just obligated to put in the book. And so I try and find some way to make the scene interesting for me to write. Maybe I'll bring in another element. Like I had a scene in, I think it was Foul Weather, where Linda ordered some plants. And she thought she was getting all these wonderful shipment of all these shrubs and plants at the door. And then all she got were sticks. because these were called bare roots, and that explains why the shipping cost was so low. These are just sticks for her to plant in the ground. Now, you think that's pretty interesting to write, but for some reason, I couldn't write this, you know, that's the level of drama in narrative art in my book, is Linda gets sticks in the mail.
Well, conflict.
Conflict. So I guess that's kitty corner. And so all my books blur into one hideous life. But for some reason, I couldn't write that scene. And so then I thought, well, you know, maybe I'm trying to get away from her the whole time because I just heard a warbler out in the driveway, and I would rather go see this warbler than listen to my poor, long-suffering wife. And again, that happened, but it didn't necessarily happen right then. And so I combined those two things so that there was this tension of Linda trying to tell me this thing and complain about getting sticks in the mail and me wanting to nod and say, yes, dear, and back out and satisfy my own selfishness and see the warbler. And that just made the scene fun to write because I made myself look really bad. And any time I can do that in a book, if I'm not making Bill look...
Yeah.
And we'll talk about maybe humor writing a little bit, too. So I don't know. I try and entertain myself, but I also at least try to make my books so that someone who's not interested in cats would still think they were funny. And when I wrote my birding book, I tried to make it so that people who weren't interested in birds would read this book and say, birding isn't as dull as I thought. I don't know. I don't know if that's any kind of an answer. We'll be right back with more of What Were You Thinking? After these words from our sponsors.
What Were You Thinking? We'll be right back after Bob gets the ducks out of his living room. Don't go away.
It's hard to find time for your furry family member. That's where Camp Bow Wow comes in. All-day play and overnight camp, daycare and boarding for dogs. Everything is included. Large play areas for fun and exercise. Spacious cabins, comfy cots, even live camper cams to watch from a computer or smartphone. Camp Bow Wow offers the best care and is the place to go where a dog can be a dog. For locations and more information, visit campbowwow.com.
Yuppie Puppy City Kitty provides pet lovers an opportunity to earn up to 50% commission selling our premium pet products. Advocate Gina Brick says, the opportunity to share such a quality product line with other pet lovers is amazing. The support of the Yuppie Puppy City Kitty family while working the business is a true gift. Mention special code PETLIFE when you enroll today and receive 3 additional products free. Find us at www.ypckpets.com. That's ypckpets.com.
When we ran out, we stopped using it.
Why would you stop?
Why undo all the good that's been accomplished? We thought everything was fine, and that was not a good thing.
No.
He started stinking. It was awful.
Shedding comes back, loss of hair, lots of dandruff.
Scratching will return. His shedding will increase.
If I ever took Roy off of Dinovite, he would go back to his hair loss.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dinovite.
When I get to about 3/4.
Oh, no. I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order. Dinovite.com.
Each and every day, she is getting that Dinovite.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
Don't do what I did and run out.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com. Okay, ducks are in the pond, rabbits in his hutch, and monkeys...
Oh, in my car!
Oh, okay, well, I go check my insurance policy. We'll turn you back over to Bob.
Hi, we're back with What Were You Thinking? And you're listening to a special show with Bob Tart and Bill Holm doing a presentation on memoir writing. And we hope that this will help anybody who wants to write a pet memoir, and especially who wants to write it so that agents and publishers will be interested in it.
Great answer.
Thanks.
So that's here, part of being a book character, is always...
Being a sycophant when you have to.
Yes, you'll laugh, like being Ed McMahon, sort of. You'll laugh, and you say, oh, great.
And we'll talk in a second about, Bill will talk about how to be in someone else's book.
How to be a book character.
Yeah, because I've yet to be a book character in anyone's book. So here's a more thematic, I'm just going to skip a couple paragraphs in here, but so this is an introduction or the opening chapter to Featherbrain. And so in Kitty Cornered, where I was action-oriented, this is more a way of introducing what the entire book is about without it necessarily being so action. This is more explanatory, but I think it explains it in kind of an interesting way, I hope. I should have listened to my parents. More than 50 years ago, they had warned me about associating with the wrong sorts of people for fear of what would happen to my priorities in life. First, they railed against cheats and liars, thieves, swindlers, braggarts, and the morally lax. When I got older, drug users and dropouts from society topped the list. Though they had never specifically mentioned birders, I should have had the common sense to steer clear of their influence, too. Now look what had become of me. On a sunny June morning, I had ducked out of work to skulk around a sewage pond. A facility employee at the sewage pond waved as his truck scooted past, smiling, I was sure, at the idea that anyone would visit his workplace for fun. But the shorebird migration was in full swing, and I had hopes of finding a rare species. For reasons I didn't understand, sandpipers, plovers, and other wading birds gravitated towards sewage ponds on their way to their breeding grounds. My ability to tell those birds apart was non-existent. My only chance was shooting scads of photos and trying to identify them later by scouring 3 shorebook reference books, 5 general birding field guides, 3 iPad apps, and the internet. So far, I hadn't found any shorebirds at all, just sheep. Finding a good bird in my little corner of West Michigan had been an obsession for over a decade. Oh, by the way, this reading will take 2 minutes. I'd seen rare birds passing through the area, from cattle egrets to greater white-fronted geese, but only because reports from other birders who had discovered them told me exactly where to look. I had yet to find a noteworthy species of my own, a bird that other birders would want to see. Ferreting out a, quote, good bird would indicate that I had finally arrived, achieving bona fide rather than bumbling birder status. It would jolt me with a surge of happiness, like a bibliophile discovering a Dead Sea Scroll at a rummage sale, or a fossil hunter recognizing a whale vertebrate in a backyard boulder. Like a broken clock that wasn't even right twice a day because the hands had fallen off, I didn't have much chance of success. But I love birds more than anything in the world, with the possible exception of my wife and our cats. So even if I failed, there really wasn't a downside to doing what made me happy, other than the public humiliation of announcing yet again another bogus identification to the online birding community. But I was determined to keep trying. So that's kind of an example of doing a beginning that isn't really a scene, but I think it lays out pretty clearly. I don't think there's any doubt what the book is about after that. Yeah.
Nice example.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So would you like to talk a little bit about being a character in other people's books?
No. No, it's an odd feeling. I mean, it's sort of a through the looking glass sort of a thing. I mean, the only reason I agreed to do it, to be allowed to be a book character, which was in Bob's first book, was, you know, he showed me the draft of the first couple chapters, and he asked me if it would be okay. And I said, sure, because I figured, you know, well, this is going nowhere. And so 120,000 copies later, I'm memorialized. In fact, my first mention is, let's see, you're building a duck pen, right? And I decided to undertake the construction of a brand new poultry wing, assisted by my good friend Bill Holm, the only person I knew whose mechanical aptitude dwarfed mine. So right away... But that's part of being a book character. First, the number one rule is you're this free-floating sort of entity, is to find someone who has no friends, and then you just sort of, you know, somehow attach that way. And like I said, you have to be willing to, you know, flatter them and ingratiate yourself in some way and, you know, pretend that he's very interesting. And also to pretend that I'm something less than I really am. But that's not really true. I'm just kidding on that one. But it is sort of an odd feeling. And
yeah, what's it like reading a... I haven't had this experience. What's it like reading a book and you are in it?
I try to detach myself from it as much as possible and try not to think of it as myself. But no, I mean, I think it's a problem. It comes down to how do you portray people you know in a book, which is, you know, it's, again, you can, whether you tell the truth about them. And so things you write are essentially true. I mean, I don't know if my mechanical ineptitude dwarfs yours. I think they're probably about equal. But I don't know. I mean, it's you look at yourself as a character, I think, when you see yourself portrayed in something else. And then you hope nobody reads it.
Yeah. It's a funny thing writing about, when you're doing a memoir, it's a funny thing writing about people. Because I think my books would be, in a way, much stronger if I wrote a lot of times what really happened. But you don't want to hurt people's feelings. You don't want to get sued. You don't want to step on too many toes. So there's a lot of good material I just end up not putting in the books. And I wish I could, especially about Bill.
Oh, jeez.
So, yeah.
Did you get paid for him abusing you at this point?
No, I actually enjoy it. I mean, that's the sad part.
This one offended the prophet.
I pay him, in fact. To include
I'm
me.
Hoping you at least got something out of it.
Well, it's funny because when you write about people, you want to kind of have them boil down to be one certain thing. So Bill is always kind of one certain thing. You're kind of a smart aleck and a curmudgeon in the books, right?
Yes.
But generally, it's smarter than I am, I would say.
I pretend to be, but I think it's clear that I'm not the way I'm portrayed.
And what I have to do is I have a boiled-down version of myself. The voice of my books, the Bob that's in the book, is, you know, in a way it's a lot like me. It's a certain aspect of me, but the humorous aspect of the book is that, for one thing, our animals are always smarter than I am. I'm usually wrong about everything, right? And I portray myself for humor as a neurotic.
For humor?
Okay. Well, that's true, though, too. But
Exaggerated.
Yeah, so I exaggerate all my bad qualities for the sake of humor. But that's something you have to think about when you write a memoir, is how where you are in the book, who you are for that book. And you want to pick, really, to be the strongest voice possible to present your material. And for me, being this kind of bumbling fool that I already am, I might as well take advantage of that and make that a strong voice for creating humor in the book so that I'm constantly out. At one point, my agent wanted to call Enslaved by Ducks outsmarted by geese. So it shows how smart I am.
Well, I think it is interesting. Your character is very consistent the whole way through. I mean, it's like very self-deprecating, and in that way it's very funny. And besides being me deprecating, I mean, but I think that's part of the success, is that it really is a sort of a contained thing, just like your scenes that you talk about, you know,
yeah.
Specific, and they're relatable and clear. So anyway.
Yeah, so you kind of have to pick out the eye that's in control of your material, and that is the strongest person to write your material. And it's kind of a vague concept in a way, but it's just part of finding the voice of your book. Usually when I write a book, it takes me 5 chapters to get the tone right. And a lot of that tone is who I am, who the personality is that's presenting the material in the book. And it shifts a little bit in each book. I think the I in the birding book is a little different than the I in the other books.
I think that's right, yeah. Well, each book has its own personality,
yeah.
Where you do.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But also, when moving away from the I and moving towards your subject, a piece of advice I got that was very good from my agent was that you want to write about your subject, whatever your subject is, in a way that will get an emotional reaction right away, as soon as possible in your book, from your reader. So, in other words, when I write about Franny, my cat, is the main character in Kitty Corner, and he was very insistent that I have to make people fall in love with Franny right away in the book. And so that was kind of a challenge, because you always kind of want to spin it out and have the cat first coming and this happening. But he said, no, right away there has to be something about Franny that grabs people. And I really think that's a good point. And it can be the other way around. You can be writing about, you know, in fiction, you could be writing, or even a memoir, you can have a villain and right away get someone to intensely dislike that person, because that's another kind of hook. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So that's something that helps a lot. And again, that's also something that keeps you focused, because once it was in my mind that I need to keep Franny lovable, that's what I did. And of course, she was lovable by being able to wrap me around her little finger constantly throughout the book. One other thing I want to mention about keeping your focus tight, and this is a really painful thing, and I've always hated it. I've always resented it when agents and publishers want me to do that, but it's the elevator pitch idea, that they want you to boil down what your book is about to a sentence or two sentences. And it's, I hate it, you know, but it helps. A subtitle to Featherbrained is My Bumbling Quest to Become a Birder and Find a Rare Bird on My Own. And that's the whole book. And that's good, because you see the title and the subtitle, and you know what the book is about. Enslaved by Ducks, I have it here somewhere. The subtitle was How One Man Went from Head of the Household to Bottom of the Pecking Order. And my editor wrote that. That was very good. Foul Weather, which didn't sell well. This does not have a good subtitle. How 39 Animals and One Sock Monkey Took Over My Life. See, one problem with Foul Weather is a large chunk of Foul Weather is about my mom, who had Alzheimer's. And the publisher did not want me to put that in the description of the book and did not want to use that to sell the book, because they thought it would be too depressing, even though, you know, it was what was happening in my life. And I wanted to put that in there. And plus, you know, my sisters, I made sure they read everything I wrote about my mom. And I tried to, you know, find some humor in what was happening to us, you know, because some of the things she did were pretty amusing. But they didn't want to put that in there. I'm not blaming them. You know, I could have written my own subtitle. So I think that's why subtitles are pretty important. And then for Kitty Cornered, How Franny and Five Other Incorrigible Cats Seized Control of Our House and Made It Their Home. So again, that's kind of the elevator pitch. That's the one sentence.
What's the German one?
Oh. Wie ein Übersinger Stadt. Well, yeah, there was a question, I think. Yeah.
So, what would your sentence have been for the one?
I couldn't come up with one. I couldn't come up with one.
You couldn't come up with one that they would have liked, or you couldn't come up with one at all?
No, I don't think this book was very well focused. In a way, it's my favorite book, because I felt that Enslaved by Ducks was so controlled and so kind of pat and neat. I got a lot of people telling me how much they admired me for my work with animals, when really I'm just self-serving and lazy. And so I wanted to write kind of the flip side of Enslaved by Ducks and show all the chaos in my life. And so there wasn't a lot of a story. There were a lot of overlapping mini stories through it. So I still like
it
a lot.
Well, in a way, it was your most honest one. About yourself.
I think so, too.
Did you ever have like part of your book where it was extremely hard to write because you got like you were so like emotionally in that part?
Yeah. Yeah, I get that all the time. I don't know how you really work through it, except that once, if you can retreat to that voice, if you can retreat to the character that you become to tell your story, I think that shields you a little bit from it, and you can kind of get through it that way. And you can use that as kind of an objective way at kind of burrowing in and maybe seeing things that you wouldn't see about yourself otherwise, you know. So it's kind of armor in a way. It's a little bit armor, but you still want to make sure and, you know, let as much up as possible, yeah. If you want to really be honest about what's going on, yeah. Yeah.
I read memoirs, and I'm sure this isn't the case with yours, where my impression was it was an exercise in egotism.
Yeah.
And I wondered how you could talk about how to avoid that.
You know, Karen, you had a quote about the demon that people should listen to the angel. I think you posted it on Mid-Michigan. And do you remember what that quote was? But I mean, every time I write anything, I'm always thinking, who's going to possibly want to read this? And is this just, you know, me being egotistical? So I don't know. I guess the way around that is to be honest. I think that helps a lot because I don't try and make myself look good in a book. I'm not trying to, you know, make myself into anything that I'm not particularly, and I'm definitely, it's kind of a warts and all approach. So I guess that's a way. I think if you're honest, there's not going to be that much egotism in it.
I remember reading, what's the Irish, he wrote 3 or 4 books.
McCourt.
Yeah.
So I read Frank McCourt's books, wonderful. I read his brother's book.
Malachi.
Malachi.
And it was just one me story after another.
Yeah.
Such a difference. Yeah. And I think the other piece of it is that there has to be both the stories about me, but also what you took away from it, what you think about it, how you reflect on it. And if you don't have that, it just becomes a repetition of my experiences. And here's all the stuff I did, but you want to know, well, what does that mean to you? What do you think about that? Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like reading a series of bar stories.
Right, it was. And it's like, okay, great. So,
basics where he lived.
Yeah. Well, and I teach a class over at Bellamy Creek on Saturdays, and one of my prisoners there is writing this book, and he gave it to me, and I'm reading it. And the main thing of it was, okay, you did all these things. You did all these things. What am I supposed to feel or think about that? Am I supposed to be shocked? Am I supposed to feel bad? I mean, really, when it's just one thing after the other, you've got to give your reader sort of a roadmap. What do you want me to take away from this? What do you want me to think? So I think that was absolutely missing, and several people in the group commented on that.
Yeah, it's hard to find the story that's in your life.
Yes? Do you have a sense of who buys your book? Are they people, in terms of characters, are they people who love humor? Are they people who certainly love animals, I would think, but do you have a sense of who your audience in that respect is?
Psychologically damaged people.
That's right, yeah. It's a big audience.
I hear from a lot of... I guess it's mostly pet owners. You know, I hear from mostly animal people. Once in a while, I hear from people who say, I don't care anything about pets, but in Germans, no. But I think it's mostly pet people, I think. Occasionally, someone will say, I've had this illness or this bad thing happening, and I needed something funny to read, and a friend of mine gave me your book, and it was good. So there's that, too. I've always hoped to be able to write for larger than just the pet people but I don't know. My friend Bill Holm just arrived in front of the Chinese restaurant in the rain.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, what a coincidence. And, Bill, what we're doing here is we are just closing out now. You don't know this, but
we're standing in the rain and not heading towards the building. Standing in... Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
And what are we doing?
We're standing here in the rain.
We are. And we're closing out. I just finished editing part 2 of our exciting workshop.
You did?
And I just want to say goodbye to the people and tell them that it's over, that's it. Whatever they thought might still be coming and might redeem the show somehow.
No, nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing at all. Well, good. I mean, we didn't think there would be anyway.
No. So thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to our esteemed producer, Mark. And
Mark made it all possible.
And shoot us an email to either Bill or me at bob@petliferadio.com. I'll forward it to Bill if you have any comments. And that's about it. Check me out at bobtart.com. Follow me on Facebook. And Bill, do you want anyone to follow you on Facebook to friend you?
No, and really, you don't need to bother forwarding any emails you might get from me either.
Okay, thank you. Talk to you later, folks. Bye-bye.
Thinking about buying a monkey? How about a ferret or a skunk? Then check out the show that will answer the burning questions: where do you get them? What do you feed them? How do you take care of them? And most of all, what were you thinking? With exotic pet expert and author Bob Tart, every week on demand from PetLifeRadio.com.